Turn with me to the book of Esther. We're going to get to it this morning. Welcome back, those of you that have been on vacation for the last several of weeks and haven't heard my setup messages for the book of Esther. They will be online if they aren't already. I'm hoping several of you have asked me about those, and I'm not quite sure whether they are or not, but they will be hopefully this week. The last several messages have been long. I apologize for that, but I've been being told by several people not to apologize for that. But we do try to be done in a 45-minute time frame, and unfortunately those messages just not lend themselves to that. Hopefully this morning's will. But I'm going to tackle a lot of verses this morning, and so you know how that goes. So stand with me, please, as we read the morning passage in reverence to God's Word. Esther chapter 1. We'll begin in verse 1. We're going to read the entire chapter. Now in the days of Ahasuerus, who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel or capital, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all of his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and the governors of the provinces were before him, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and the pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king, and drinking was according to this edict: there is no compulsion. For the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mahuman, Bistha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, the 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princesses her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, delivered by the eunuchs. At this time the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in law and judgment, the men next to him being Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Mirs, Marcena, and Mamukan, the 7 princes of Persia and Media, who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. According to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? Then Mamukan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media, who have heard of the queen's behavior, will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. If it pleases the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all of his kingdom, for it is vast, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. This advice pleased the king and the princess, and the king did as Mamukin proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man be master in his own household and speak according to the language of his people. And you may be seated, and may the Lord add his blessing to the reading of the word this morning. How many of you are saying, yeah, right, guy's going to get over 22 verses in a message? We're going to try. It's interesting, as I began to look at this study, to make a determination as to how to actually take it, and reading my commentaries, and I wondered, how do you set this up? And that's the reason I spent 2 weeks, and I do hope that you would get and listen to the messages online, because you're going to hear a lot of what I set up in this morning's message in particular. But I began to think about it, and I'm going to use one of the commentaries as kind of a kickoff for it, as exactly how, as I began reading it, they used some illustrations in it, and I thought it's a perfect illustration. Have you ever tried to perform a task, any type of a task, that is delicate or extremely difficult in the midst of total chaos? The environment is absolutely total chaos. And you're trying to do something delicate or something that's extremely difficult. I've talked to Dave Forsyth numerous times, and he amazes me that he is able to intubate people and even do tracheotomies flying at 10,000 feet in turbulent weather. I mean, I've talked to him a couple of times about it, and I'm amazed that you are able to do such things. And he's quite good at what he does. But have you ever tried to do anything along those lines? Have you ever tried to be able to do something that is difficult or extremely delicate and everything around you is breaking loose? The situation, and how many of you, I just want to raise a hand because I hate using illustrations that people aren't familiar with, but how many of you are familiar with the movie, with the play, with the book Fiddler on the Roof? Oh yeah, okay, so we're not going to fall on too many deaf ears today when I use the illustration. In that book, the situation basically is this. Turn of the century, Russian Jews. It's where it's set in Russia, and there's a Jewish settlement. And there is a main character, a guy by the name of Tevye, in that, in the movie and in the play. And this main character says something and sets the stage for the movie, which is called A Fiddler on the Roof. And I want you to keep that in mind because it's going to line a thread through Esther. It's going to line a thread through the way we live today. But if you think about that, and if you're familiar with the movie, his words are quite poignant. And this is how he opens up. A fiddler on the roof. Sounds crazy, no? But here in our little village of Anatevka, you might say every one of us is a fiddler on the roof, trying to scratch out a pleasant, simple tune without breaking his neck. It isn't easy. You may ask why we stay up there if it is so dangerous. Well, we stay because Anatevka is our home. And how do we keep our balance? That I can tell you in one word: tradition. And so if you remember the setting on that, and it always, as a younger person, when I first heard the movie, it didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And so I tried to grasp the meaning of what was actually being said there. A fiddler on the roof. Can you imagine trying to play a tune on a fiddle, which is difficult to do, while balancing at the peak of a roof and going between roof and roof and roof and trying to do, keeping balance, not to break your neck at the same time that you're supposed to play out this fiddle? And so what he is saying, and what you're going to see throughout this book of Esther, is that very type of thing. The whole idea is this: we have to play out, the Jews in Esther's time have to play out a tune on their fiddle. And the hostile environment in which they live is like trying to play out that tune at the pinnacle of a roof and trying to keep our balance and trying not to simply break our necks. The people in Fiddler on the Roof, and now you have to shift gears with me. Don't always think of that. Got to shift now to Esther, and then we're going to have to shift our time also. But the time of Esther, we're doing the very same things. These Jews were living in some hostile land. They were living as foreigners in a foreign land. And they had to know and they had to realize that friends were hard to come by. You didn't know who to trust. You could trust your own, predominantly, but to trust somebody outside of that were probably hard to find, if they even existed at all. They knew at any given time their properties could be seized. They knew that their livelihood could be destroyed, that lives were in danger. And yet, the very kingdom that could call or to take their lives and to take all that they have was still their home. Can you begin to see this conflict? Can you begin to see a tension that they lived in? Do you and I live in the same type of tension today? And as you're going to see over the next several months, we absolutely do live in that same type of tension. And yet the people of Esther might very well survive quite nicely, I might say. All they have to do is keep their heads low. Keep your opinions to yourself. You capitulate to what the king wants and what all his little minions want. Okay, you do that, and you might very well survive quite nicely, as a matter of fact. The old adage, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the oil. How many of you have heard that? Okay, just so I know, the squeaky wheel. All right, so I'm all right. There's sometimes when I write this stuff out, I'm thinking, I hope they understand. I mean, it's so familiar to me. The squeaky wheel gets the oil, cuts both ways. Okay, oftentimes if you need something, you just constantly ask. Not kids. Kids do not take that advice. Okay, mom and dad say no, mom and dad mean no. Okay, but when we go to an employer or we go to a government or we go to something, you constantly ask and you constantly squeak about it. Eventually, it's like, shut him up, get some oil on it. Okay, get some oil on that squeaky wheel. It cuts both ways though, doesn't it? We may be squeaky enough, we don't want the oil, but we get it anyways. The government says, shut them up. It's the same perspective that these Jews were living in at that particular time. But think about it. Aren't these the Jews? Aren't these God's people? Aren't these people living in the midst of this era? In King Ahasuerus, by the way, I may say Ahasuerus or I may say Xerxes. Sometimes saying Ahasuerus too many times doesn't sound right. And so it Xerxes can also be said, so I may use that. It's the same guy. But here in the midst of this empire that they have, they're living as conquered people. And aren't they God's people? Aren't they the covenant people of God? The ones who were brought out of Egypt. The ones who saw the mighty works of God in actually moving in Pharaoh's heart and in the Egyptian's heart. Aren't these the ones that Moses even said about, oh Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Isn't that the same people that have seen the amazing works of God in all of their lives? Isn't God now going to look upon his people and rain down lightning bolts? Isn't he going to look upon his people and bring earthquakes to Ahasuerus and the Medes and the Persians? Isn't he going to blow them away with tornadoes? Isn't he going to show the mighty hands that he has done in the past that Moses talks about? But wait, if you remember my last several messages, it's been a long time since God has done that. It's been a long time since God has shown himself in a mighty way, a blatant divine intervention way. He's been silent from that perspective. Oh yeah, he's talked to people, and we saw that progressive of a guy, God actually ends up hiding himself from people. He started speaking through judges, then he started speaking through prophets and getting further and further and sparser, and the miracles. Wow, we haven't really had miracles since the time of Elisha. The glory of God is left, according to Ezekiel, actually seeing a picture of the glory of God going back to heaven, leaving the people in silence and hidden himself. It's nearly been a generation or so since they've actually had anybody to witness a miracle. Our situation isn't too different today, is it? If you think about it, oh, we may not face that exact type of persecution yet in our society, but other Christians worldwide do. the fear of having their properties taken, their livelihoods taken, their very lives taken from them, from a place they call home. It's our government. This is our home, and yet that is what's happening in many parts of the world. How do we as Christians, though, understand that God has said you are to live in this world, and yet you are not to be a part of it? It's one of those things. I'm supposed to live in this world and yet not be a part of it, God? It's a mandate that you have given me, and where in the world are you? You're the one that commanded it. And now you left us. Where are you? There's no more lightning bolts from heaven. We don't see that. We're living as strangers in a land that's not our home. Remember when I preached through Philippians? We looked at that. We are loyal subjects. Our allegiance is to a king that is far away. Oh yeah, we're called to live in Rome. We're called to live in Philippi. We're called to live in the provinces of Rome or in today's society. We're called to live in our country of America, which is becoming less and less godly, if it ever truly was, but we're becoming much more godless. And we're called to live in that particular time. We are citizens in a country that doesn't like us, and it's even hostile to us. And our loyalties and our allegiances are sometimes different than our neighbors. And might I even submit that sometimes they're even different than some of our family members. Sometimes those differences make a big difference. Sometimes they rise to the surface. Sometimes they do matter. Sometimes they make agitation. Sometimes they bring something good about those differences. But sometimes they just don't simply matter. But there are still differences in the country in which we live. And yet there are those times too when our loyalty to our king makes a major difference. When the proclamation of truth about our king and who we truly have allegiance to, we get hammered for. There's an old Chinese proverb that the nail that sticks out the furthest is the one that gets hammered. Okay? You speak the truth long enough, you're going to get hammered by this society. But hey, it's home. Where we live. Gotta play my fiddle on a roof, on a pitch top because, or on the pitch of the roof because it's home. And then don't we actually struggle, as I said over the last several weeks, with the hiddenness of God? Don't we struggle with that in our own lives? Trying to discern the will of God. Lord, you did it before. Why don't you write on that wall? Lord, we'll set one wall aside at our church where when we really have an issue, we'll come, we'll pray before the wall, your hand will come out of the wall, and writing on there, discerning what the will is for my particular life. Should I marry that person or not? Lord, where's your hand? He doesn't deal that way anymore. He doesn't speak to us that way anymore. We've had dreams. We have many godly dreams. Sometimes we have dreams that aren't so godly. Rich and famous and prestige and success is all we're looking for. But then many times we have dreams of actually godly things. We wanted a godly spouse. We wanted a godly family. We want to raise them. We have prayed for the salvation of loved ones. We have cried out to God for the salvation of our loved ones. We have spent time answering the knock at the door. We have know the promises of seek and you shall find. We proclaim that. And in the midst of that, they get dashed. My dreams are dashed because God isn't standing on the other side of that door all the time. Where are you? You're hidden. We wrestle just like the people of Esther wrestled with. Like Tevye. And later on, you're going to see Mordecai in this story. We're fiddling out a tune precariously perched on a roof, trying to proclaim the tune that God himself has given us. And yet God is nowhere to be seen. It's confusing, it's hard, and sometimes nearly impossible to keep our balance. And so this morning, I want us to begin to see that what you find in the book of Esther is so typical of culture since day one. You assimilate, you capitulate, you become like the culture that you find yourself in. You assimilate, that's what it's called, assimilation, or you lose hope. That is the potential problems in the book of Esther, and it is the potential problems of you and I today living in a culture as fiddlers on a roof trying to eke out a tune in the midst of a culture which doesn't like us. We either assimilate to the culture, or the tendency may be to lose hope. So don't be too hard on these Jews. I hope we are able to see ourselves in this, in our daily lives, current daily lives. We either assimilate to our culture, we become like our culture, or maybe our tendency becomes to give up and lose hope and begin to despair, because where is God in the midst of all of this? The power and the presence of the government upon the nation of Israel at this particular point was obvious. The soldiers could be heard marching in the street at all times. The partying and the reveling of this opulent lifestyle, and you're going to see as I set this up this morning, could be heard anywhere within the city. Culture all around them cried out to capitulate. They saw their political leaders. They saw their political leaders living for themselves. Opulent lifestyle, telling lies. I'm going to leave that go. That's all I need to say. But they saw their political leaders living lies, telling lies, living opulent lifestyles that were nearly disgusting to most people. The political games that were being played, the soldiers outside at any given time walking on the streets. They saw bad people making out good. They saw evil triumphing over good constantly in their lives. Psalm 73, verses 8 through 12. Amazing. Read Psalm 73. If you want to get an encouragement from the Word of God on watching bad people come to good and wondering why evil seems to always triumph. Psalm 73, they scoff and speak with malice. They're talking about the evil people. Loftily, they threaten oppression. They set their mouths against the heavens and their tongues stretch through the earth. Therefore, his people turn back to them and find no fault in them. Listen to this. And they say, how can God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High? Behold, these are wicked, always at ease. They increase in riches. All in vain have I kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. Hear the psalmist saying, why bother? My neighbor, all he does is curse. He wouldn't know morality if it hit him between the eyes, and yet look at what he's got. Look at everything that he's got. He's prosperous in everything that he actually does. Oh, it's in vain that I have kept my heart clean. The obscene wealth and the opulence that you're going to see portrayed in this book is not used for the good of others. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not against wealth. I'm not against having things, nice things, good things. But when it is used simply for self-indulgence, as you will see here, the power of the king is going to become so evident that it's all about him. And the Jewish people then find themselves getting disgusted with it, just like you and I do. They find that every turn, state-controlled temples shows the power of the king. What are they to do? To assimilate? To lose hope? Temptation is to give up. The temptation for the Jews was to give up at this particular time. To give up on the promises that God had given to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. To give up on the promise that he had given to David, that someday there was going to rise from him the root of Jesse, their Savior, the Messiah, that one who's going to sit on the throne forever. It is tendency to give up because we haven't seen God. Just like the Jews hadn't seen God, and they saw a culture which is all around them turning their back completely upon God. The Persian Empire had one goal as they continued to conquer the world, and that was to assimilate the people that they were conquering. They will become like us. Now, lest you think that that isn't relevant today, take a sociology course. Just take any modern sociology course, because they will talk about cultural assimilation in this class. And it is absolutely important for us to understand this. Cultural assimilation is a concept within sociology in which an ethnic minority adopts the beliefs, languages, and customs of the dominant community, losing their own culture in the process. The phenomenon usually occurs when two or more communities come into contact with each other due to a shared geographical boundary or immigration. Once this happens, they cannot help but affect each other's culture. Understanding that this cultural assimilation can be voluntary. It just happens because you're living with neighbors. You're closely in the culture, and so it can voluntarily happen. And then it can be forced. It can be forced upon people, such as what the Medes and the Persian era does. They're going to force people to assimilate. Teddy Roosevelt, unless we think that this wasn't something in our own lifetime, and still goes on today. I read something in the process of doing this, and this is a sidelight. Turn of the 20th century, Teddy Roosevelt's going to say something amazing, and I haven't read here so that I definitely read exactly what he says. Talking about immigration, we're the great melting pot as a country, or as a world country, right? Everybody comes here to live the American dream, and yet we see that today, that they refuse to assimilate. They want their own culture. Well, they want what America can give them and offer them in the way of good things and blessings. But they're not going to assimilate. They don't want anything to do with the American culture. Good thing, bad thing, we can debate that in Sunday school if you want. But listen to what Teddy Roosevelt said about this very thing, about assimilating the immigrants that were coming to this country by boatloads. We should insist that if the immigrant who comes here does in good faith become an American and assimilates himself to us, he shall be treated on an exact equality with everyone else, for it is an outrage to discriminate against any such man because of creed or birthplace or origin. Good stuff. Listen to the second paragraph. But this is predicated upon the man's becoming in every fact an American and nothing but an American. If he tries to keep segregated with men of his own origin and separated from the rest of America, then he isn't doing his part as an American. There can be no divided allegiance here. We have room for but one language here, and that is the English language. For we intend to see that the crucible turns our people out as Americans of American nationality and not as dwellers in a polyglot boarding house, means speaking many languages. And we have room for but one sole loyalty, and that is loyalty to the American people. Now, if you're a true patriot, you're going to stand up and say, yeah, that makes a lot of sense to us. But in a spiritual sense, what is it saying? What is it saying in a spiritual sense? Now, there's part of what I agree with what Teddy says. There's part of it we have to agree that if we're going to maintain a culture in which we continue to hold to certain morals and certain values, then those that come here will have to assimilate to some degree. But to say that we have but room for one soul loyalty, and that soul loyalty, S-O-U-L, by the way, soul, inner being, soul loyalty, is as an American people. How does that fit to us as census Christians? To understand that we have an allegiance and a loyalty to the King of Kings, to one who sits in the heavenly realm, that someday will call us home, and understanding that we are simply foreigners living in sometimes a very hostile land, that our ultimate allegiance is to the God of this universe, not to America. Our sole loyalty needs to be as Christians to the King of Kings who sits upon the sovereign throne. That's who we are. That's who we must need to continue to be. But also I want you to keep in mind that these Jews that we're going to see here in the book of Esther lived in a kind of a weird environment which they didn't necessarily have to be in. Because most pressing on the Jews of this time, they were quite removed. The Jews that we're going to be talking about in Persia at this time, in under Ahasuerus' reign, were quite removed from fervent, faithful Jewish followers of Joshua, who had said, "But as for me in my house, we will serve the Lord." Now, what do I mean by that? How are they removed? They're Jews, right? You have to keep in mind that a generation earlier, 50 years earlier, under Darius, Nehemiah, Ezra, and a faithful remnant were given permission and fanfare to return back to Jerusalem with the intentions of constantly building their wall for protection as a people back to the very land that God had promised them where the temple had been. They were given permission by their conquerors to do that. And a majority of those people took that opportunity to go back under great duress and a lot of fighting going on, but they were given permission to go back. Here is a remnant of people which did not go. They didn't go. The faithful, fervent followers of Joshua, "But as for me and my people, we will serve the Lord." They found themselves back in Jerusalem, rebuilding the temple, rebuilding what God has given them, rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, rebuilding their people, what God had commanded for them to do. And yet, who do we find here? We find people that just found a peaceable life to some degree. We can capitulate, we can assimilate into the culture at this time. And we can become like our captors. Because life isn't too bad. Life is quite comfortable. As long as I don't make waves, and I submit to you, as long as I don't live my faith openly, things are okay. And I think you're going to see that as the book of Esther unfolds. As long as I don't proclaim an open faithfulness to the God of heaven and make those waves, life is pretty good here for me. I don't have my head cut off too often. None of our people are under too much persecution here. And so if they find themselves assimilating to this, a peaceful life, a peaceable life without the proclamation of the truth of God is not a life for a Christian to be living at all. And yet that's what we find here. Let sleeping dogs lie, out of sight, out of mind. Don't fix that which ain't broken. That's their adage. That was what they lived by. Don't make any waves. Don't let the king see that we're messed up out here. Don't speak of God. Don't speak of our faith. Don't speak of our intermarriage thing. Don't make the waves, and they'll let us alone. Exile had been kind to them up to this point. It's not going to continue, but they forgot completely that the pagan, godless environment, the pagan, godless government which had them governed at this particular time could at any time rise up against them and cause hostility toward them. So that's one of the temptations that they have, to assimilate into that environment. To say, look, it's okay, I can live this way because life is good for me. The second temptation then is that of losing hope. They could lose hope in the God of creation. They could lose hope in the God who had given the covenant to all of their forefathers. They lived under this fickle and very capricious ruler, sometimes cruel, and yet God is very silent. So do they begin to think, does God even care anymore? Do we need to wake him up? You know, as some of the atheists say, go wake your God up. Okay, apparently he's asleep. Do we need to do that today? Because where has he been? He seems to be out of sight and out of mind. We speak to these people. We speak to the Persians. We speak to our captors about God, Jehovah. And every time we do, you know what they say to us? Where's your God? You're a fool. Really? Where's your God? At least you can go to our temples and see our gods. They may not act, but you can at least see them. Where is your God? We speak to them, and yet God doesn't show himself powerful any longer. So they could give up hope. They can find themselves in despair, even knowing the very covenant-keeping God has been faithful all these times. It takes more than Tevye's tradition to be able to help them through. What Tevye is going to find out as you see the book of Fiddler on the Roof unfold. It takes more than tradition to live distinctly God-oriented. And today, it takes more than tradition. It takes more than sometimes simply lip service to live a Christ-like community that he has called us to do. Now, the book of Esther is going to set this stage for us, twofold answer. Temptation to assimilate or to lose despair. Now, this concept I want you to be careful with. And I don't want you just to brush it off and say, well, guy's a little crazy. He come up with something and he stretched the passages here. One of the things that I think the book of Esther does in helping us to be able to deal with this fear or tendency to assimilate or our fear or our tendency to despair in God is to simply begin to look at things satirically. To begin to look at the ridiculousness of things, to begin to look at the humor of the world and the craziness of what's going to be presented, because that's the only way you're going to be able to read this book, especially chapter 1. It begins exactly where we are supposed to begin, and so often we have this idea that as Christians, everything is formal. You got to put your robe on, you got to get your Bibles out, and you got to speak in clear, analytical terms to be able to figure God out. And I think there's time. I think Jesus himself used satire. I think oftentimes he used satire, and I think the scriptures do. So when we see certain things that we are able to laugh at, then I think we need to learn to understand that's exactly sometimes what keeps us from going over the edge, from what keeps us from assimilating, from what keeps us from losing despair, what keeps us from going cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. I'm using all kind of lines today, okay? It's what keeps us from it, is looking at satire, to look at the ridiculousness of certain things. And then I also think that the book of Esther is going to show us that God works many, many times in opposite directions from what the world says, and many times in different ways himself. Don't pigeonhole God. Don't say that he has to act any particular way each and every time, or it's not God. Don't say, if I don't see the handwriting on the wall, it's the only fleece that I'm going to lay out. If it doesn't speak that particular way, then it's not of God. Don't say that if he doesn't come through my confidant friend or my pastor or one of the elders, or if he doesn't lead me each morning to that particular passage, just opening up my Bible and I find it right there. If that isn't the only way God's going to work in my life, then I don't want to hear it. Do not pigeonhole God. Because so often, God has his inscrutable ways. His ways are not our ways. His thoughts are so much higher than our thoughts. He will speak in many different ways and work in many different ways. However, the caveat to all of that is it is never contradiction to this. Ever. So find ourselves constantly in it. But don't pigeonhole God to say he needs to work in this particular way, and if he doesn't, then it's not God speaking. That's what we're going to see in the book of Esther. First, satire all the way through. And secondly, how God is going to actually work. We know God works differently. Look at how he worked in the book of Exodus and the mighty and blatant intervention ways. And now, to this particular point, you're going to see him constantly at work, silently behind the scenes. You're going to see satire in this opulence of wealth and stupidity of advice. I mean, in this day of enlightenment and feminism, this passage had to enrage certain people. I would love to read this passage. Just read it. Not preach it. Just read this to a local feminist group. Okay? It'd have to just put them right on the edge of their seat. Okay? That every man will be the boss. Okay, you're going to see the satire in this. Seriously. Okay, oh yeah, we run our homes, but only when our wives let us run our homes. You know that, guys. Okay, we make that final decision. Honey, is it okay if I do that? We know the truth of the matter. And so you see satire all the way through it. You're going to see this idea that they act like knights of the round table. Strong knights of the round table. And really, I try to think of an image, and the first thing that popped into my mind was SpongeBob and Patrick with crowns on. I mean, that's the picture that you see. Okay, I don't know why when I thought about an illustration that I'm trying to think. Knights of the Round Table is what they're appeared to be, and yet we as Christians really see them as SpongeBob and Patrick with crowns on their heads. We're going to do this. Yes, we will. Okay? I mean, that's what you see here. We see the satire in it. They appear to be strong leaders. In reality, they're the seven dwarves. You know, that's what we see. There's always a powerful answer to the seemingly despair of conquered people under the control of these tyrants. Can I tell you this much, too, as I begin to think about satire? Have you ever known a tyrant or a dictator throughout history that was ever able to laugh at themselves? You think about it. People in ultimate control of something have very little time to laugh at themselves. And so what do the people do? They make up stupid cartoons about their leaders. The emperor has no clothes on. Okay, that whole idea. You make up satirical perspective of who they are. You begin to laugh at them. And it enrages the dictator. It enrages the emperor at that particular time because he doesn't have the ability to laugh at himself. Many leaders throughout history have been brought down through satire, through writers who have been able to set out to bring the satirical approach to their kingdoms. Satire cuts down the splendor. You're going to see that. Satire is going to cut down the splendor. It brings down the fear of authority by showing its ridiculous sides. We as Christians need to begin to see that. And not like Psalmist in 73 says, look at the bad guy. Everything he has is turning out. I've done everything in vain keeping my heart clean. We need to look at the satire portion of that. Saying, oh yeah, he may have everything. But he's an idiot. He's got no respect in the community. I've seen the stupidest decisions come out of that guy's face. That's how we begin to look at it. Now, we don't say that to them. We're trying to win them to Christ. Okay? So we don't say that to their face. But that's how we begin to think, because satire is what will keep us many times from going over the edge and losing despair or to assimilate into this culture. Our hope will be maintained through faith, even though God is silent. He's still bringing about his will. As we said in Proverbs 19:21, many are the plans of men, but God will stand forever. We see the conflict between these seven dwarves and this invisible power that obviously is at work in the book of Esther. And we said, okay, Mahuman and Mamukin, love those names, by the way. I'm going to name, if we ever have any more grandkids, I'm going to push the parents to name Mahuman and Mamukin. Okay? Twins. They aren't here, but that would be great. I thought about that this week. But to sit there and to think, listen to the stupid advice as they're going to do. The seven dwarves are giving the king the advice here. And we see an invisible, amazing, sovereign, powerful, almighty God at work using the stupidity of man to bring about his will. What we're going to see in the book of Esther. Part two next week. I'm actually going to read and preach through this kingdom. We're going to begin to see in the midst of this empire. It's an amazing empire, by the way. You begin to look at Ethiopia down to India. Sea to shining sea. He controls. As a matter of fact, it's so big that he has four capitals. Four capital cities. The one we're going to deal with, Susa, is where this party is going to actually occur. You're going to see the opulence of this place. You're going to see that if anybody knew how to throw a kegger, as we would say in the hillbilly country up here, it's King Ahasuerus. Okay, he knew how to throw a party. And that's exactly what he's going to do. It's going to last 6 months. And you're going to see in the midst of all of that, the ridiculousness of it. You're going to see just how silly this whole thing is in the midst of it. And behind it, a silent, hidden God in absolute control of what he wants to bring about.